From KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Matthew Diffie is my guest. He's a cartoonist for The New Yorker, and he has compiled his cartoons in a brand new book, which is hysterical. But it's not for everyone. The book is called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. Matthew Diffie, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
It's a funny book.
Well, thank you.
And I'm glad you
must. You must be very smart and attractive.
Yes, thank you, thank you for including me. I actually tried to sell some cartoons to New Yorker.
So oh, yeah?
And then all I got was rejections, rejection after rejection after rejection.
Yeah, well, that's par for the course. I still get it all the time.
They do? They still reject you even?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You know, all of us are supposed to turn in 10 a week.
Yeah.
Our sort of weekly batch of cartoons. And, you know, on a really good week, you sell one. So 90% rejection is, you know,
perfect.
Success. Yeah.
Well, how many times did you send in cartoons before they accepted one?
Oh, to get in? Well, my sort of origin story, I guess, is kind of strange. I mean, it's very strange. Nobody else has done this. But I was up in Boston at the time, and I was writing jokes for comedians and trying to do stand-up, and I was also trying to do art, but I had never thought about doing cartooning. And The New Yorker did a contest, actually, the first ever cartoon issue in 1998. And you had to send in the whole cartoon, not like the caption contest, you know. They do,
right.
I had to do the drawing and the joke. So I was, you know, kind of doing both of those parts, but I'd never put them together. So I did and sent it off, and Bob Mankoff, who was cartoon editor at The New Yorker, was the judge of the contest. And I ended up winning the contest and met him. And then he said, you know, hey, you should start submitting cartoons. So that's how I kind of got, you know, at least a toe in the door first. And then I started submitting, and I think on the fifth week, I sold one, and I thought, of course, you know, I was hopping on the gravy train.
Yeah.
It didn't turn out to be the case, but, you know, I submitted every week that first year, and I was doing 15 because, you know, I wanted to impress him.
Uh-huh.
And that first year I sold four, so
so
a lot of rejections. Then the next years it got a little better, and, you know, been doing it almost, I guess, 15 years now, so.
And you don't get one in every issue, or? Are you kind
of... No, not at all. I mean, there was a couple of years where I was really hitting it hard, and I've taken, you know, a foot off the gas pedal just to finish this book.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, mostly cartoons from The New Yorker, but a lot of original stuff that I...
Just for this book, just for the handsome and attractive...
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, what about that first one? What was the gag in your first one?
Oh, for the contest?
Yeah.
Yeah, you had to do cartoons about hotel life. That's what the contest, you know, guideline said, and I don't really know what that is, but my cartoon that won it was, you know, like a hotel room. This is one of my favorite things, by the way, describing cartoons.
Yes, I was going to hold your cartoons up to the microphone so the listeners could see them.
So it was a hotel room, and a couple, like sort of a Midwestern-looking husband and wife couple have just come into the room, and you kind of set their bags on the ground, one set a bag on the bed, and the husband is turning to leave, I guess, and seeing the inside of the door of his hotel room has a sign that says "Do not disturb" hanging from the inside of the door, and so he says to his wife, "Oh, great! I guess we're stuck in here." Which is a long way to go for a joke that's a little mild. But anyway, that one won the contest. I guess Bob saw something in the, you know, I turned in 7 or 8 ideas. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Any of the other ones, but I guess that was enough. Plus, you know, the fact that I was already, I could draw, I guess, so.
Yeah, well, so you had studied fine art, or?
Yeah, I wanted, that was my first, you know, plan to be a fine artist, a real artist, you know, selling in galleries, eventually museums, and, you know, all that business, but.
What was
it? And I was doing fine, but, you know, I'd been at it for years and years, and, you know, probably needed 5 more years before it actually happened for me.
You were a painter, or what?
Yeah, I was a painter. I did abstract painting and, you know, all kinds of painting, you know, figurative stuff too. But what I was most serious about was, you know, abstract, I guess, or a version of abstract expressionism.
So you didn't paint pigeons on a...
No. But, you know, I was happy to do a cartoon about Jackson Pollock, who I did study back in the day. So
Yeah.
That's what you call it. I don't know. This is a cartoon in the book, we should say, which is, I can describe it again. It's two pigeons up on a high ledge. outside of a building, two pigeons, and the perspective shows that they're way up high, and you can see sort of the hints of what the street is below. And so one of the pigeons is saying to the other, I guess my biggest influence is probably Pollock. So that is a sophisticated poop joke.
Now, yes. So sometimes you get scatological in your humor, but do people ever say to you, "What? I didn't get that. What was that?"
Oh yeah. Yeah. All the time. I mean, there's cartoons when I flip through the magazine that I don't get.
Oh, sometimes it's puzzling.
You can't get everything. Yeah.
But somebody thought it was funny.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, the cartoons you see from me and from every cartoonist in New Yorker are a combination of what we think is funny, but also what the editors think is funny. So sometimes they will pick cartoons that aren't even my favorite.
Think you have like a surefire winner, but you throw in some others and they take the...
I mean, but they're the experts on what's perfect for the New Yorker. So sometimes they will pick, you know, I'll have what to me is a funnier, you know, laugh out loud kind of idea, and they'll pick something that's a little bit milder, you know, more New Yorkery sometimes, and that's just the way it is. So actually in this book and in some other books, I've edited some books called The Rejection Collection.
Yeah.
You're able to put those rowdier, hopefully funnier ideas in some of your own stuff. So
now you are, I can tell from your voice, are not originally a New Yorker. And from your area code.
What are you talking about? No, I can't even do a New York accent. Yeah, I'm from Texas. I grew up in Denton, Texas, north of Dallas.
And now you live in Los Angeles. So
now I live in Los Angeles.
What does a guy like you know about New Yorkers?
Yeah, exactly. I've been all over. I was in Texas, I guess, more than anywhere else. And then I went to North Carolina, then South Carolina, then New Hampshire, and then, I guess, 4 years in Boston. And then 12 years in New York City.
Oh.
And I like to tell people I enjoyed the first 10. The last two were kind of, wears on you a bit. And then I went to Austin for a couple years, just trying to get back to Texas, and just moved to L.A. almost 2 years ago. So we'll see how that works out. So far, you know, it's pretty nice. I don't have to drive, so that's
How can you live in L.A. and not drive?
Well, I work at home. No, easy of being a cartoonist.
And is that do you still paint, or is this, you just do the cartoon?
I have painted, you know, sporadically all these years, and actually just moving into a new house in L.A., I got all my stuff out of storage from New York, and a lot of painting stuff, so I'm excited to do that in the next few years. So if there's any gallery owners out there that are looking for an abstract expressionist who dabbles at cartooning, they can call me. There's something nice about just doing artwork that doesn't need like a concept, you know, a joke.
Right.
You know, you spend most of the work of cartooning is in fact, you know, coming up with the ideas.
You don't just
mostly thinking, not inking.
You don't just sit down with your pencil and just start drawing stuff. But you have to.
I don't. There are cartoonists who do that. The doodle school. They just sort of start doodling things, and they doodle a little figure, and they put a pirate hat on him, and now I'll come up with a joke. I've never been able to work that way. I just end up doodling and forgetting to think of comedy. So for me, it's always I start with words first and concepts, and I start, you know, just stream of consciousness kind of, you know, come, like the first thing that pops into my head will be whatever it is, like penguin for some reason, and I'll just start listing things about penguins. You know, they're black and white, and they waddle, and they live in the Arctic or wherever they live. And so I'll just, you know, go until I get some sort of a nugget that connects with something else and try to make a cartoon about it. But I could also wander from penguins to kayaks to Eskimos to, you know, skiing, and end up doing a cartoon about skiing rather than penguin. Because it doesn't matter what I come up with, as long as I come up with
something. As long as it's funny. Is it easier if somebody says we want cartoons about hotel life, or is it easier?
It's a nice break, I should say. I don't know if it's always easier, because I'm sure if I got assignments every day, that would become a drudgery, and I would love to be able to just free-form ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It is nice the few times when I get an assignment like that, like if I'm doing an advertising job or some sort of a... And by that, I mean, I just need a cartoon for an advertising, you know, use.
Right.
It is nice when I get that, because it's rare, and you know where the boundaries are and the parameters, and
Do a cartoon, you know, yeah. Do a cartoon about liquor or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Or whatever product or service, you know, somebody wants.
Yeah.
I did some cartoons for Altoids at one point, and, you know, they were introducing some sort of really extra spicy hot gum.
Yeah.
And so I came up with some ideas for cartoons that that were hot. It's a long explanation, but it won an award of some sort, but it was like cartoons that ended up being in the New Yorker as cartoons. They looked like cartoons, but gradually the Altoids logo was burning through them, so that if you flip through three of them, and then the third page was the picture of the Altoids, really hot gum. And so in every one of the cartoons, it was slightly burning. The cartoon characters in the cartoon were referencing, is it getting hotter in here, or just me? So it was that was a really fun, you know, conceptual task.
And did they send you a case of Altoid gum?
No, they should have. Yeah. They did pay me, if I remember correctly. Not in gum, but in...
Getting paid is nice. I guess getting paid is nice, too.
Yeah. So you're up in Santa Cruz, right?
That's correct, yes. Have you been up here?
I don't think I have been up there. But I've heard nothing but good things.
Well, there's nothing but good up here.
Yeah, it sounds kind of like Eden, some sort of idyllic world up there.
It's paradisical.
Yeah, outside of the L.A. and San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. We're kind of protected here.
Yeah.
We're talking with Matt Diffie, and he's just compiled a book of his New Yorker cartoons and other cartoons, and it's called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. So, were you always a funny guy?
Yeah, I guess so. Not around my family. They were shocked when this happened. But among my friends, I was always sort of... I was actually named most witty in high school.
Ah.
So
your teachers made you stand outside a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, I was always doing comedy and skits and stuff. I was that kid. But I was also always drawing, so... It's funny that I never thought to be a cartoonist. I was just, the two things were completely separate to me all my life. Until I was 29, that's when I entered that contest.
Mm-hmm. And so were you interested in comedy? Did you have comedy influences and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, at one point really wanting to be a stand-up comedian or a comedy writer or a, you know, like for TV or something, or make short films and stuff. And I loved the same kind of jokes that I do now in cartoon form. I loved Stephen Wright and, you know, Mitch Hedberg and Woody Allen and this kind of Emo Phillips is less known, but
yeah, he was fun.
A bunch of comedians, you know, love his jokes. But yeah, just sort of the guys who made those just like conceptual one-liner type jokes. And, you know, when you think about it, those are really cartoons. And in a cartoon, the drawing does part of the work. But
right.
Still, the kind of jokes I like, and in this book, you'd probably notice that there was some little tangential jokes that are just in the margins and
yes.
Here and there, and in the introductions. I got to write some that are
just straight comedy.
They weren't so dependent. Yeah, just joke jokes.
In a way, a cartoon is sort of a merger of those conceptual ideas and a sitcom, because you have a situation in which the comedy.
Yeah, and you have a. This is, you know, a lot of times we think about what we do in terms of almost like a very short film. Because everything that a filmmaker has to do, we have to do. You know, we have to cast the characters by, you know, how we draw them. And then we have to put the costumes on. There has to be the right costume for the character. And the setting has to be correct. And the lighting. And, you know, and then we actually direct the performances by how we draw the facial expressions. And of course, write the script. So it's in a tiny microcosm, in a single still frame, it's like it should be at least like a little movie.
Well, I guess
that's what's great about it, being able to be fully in control of all the elements. It's one of the few pure forms like that.
It's not collaborative in the way that a film would be.
Yeah, that's the one difference, I guess. And the fact that, you know, films cost billions of dollars and you can do ours with a number two pencil and a sheet of typing paper.
But in that way, it's like painting, too. I mean,
yeah.
Before photography, painting, you know, you stand in some of those big paintings, and you can see how they were telling a story with those paintings.
Yeah.
Look at them for hours.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my painting, training comes to bear in my cartoons. It sounds silly to talk about, but I think a lot about, you know, the way the shapes and the composition work. And, you know, in a way, I think that's why I do all my cartoons in a square box. You know, they all have a frame around them, or almost all of them.
Right. Uh-huh.
It's just because as a painter, that's what I'm used to. I'm used to having edges defined, and the composition has to fit in that shape and work in it. So that's probably why I do that.
I found it interesting when I was reading your book to analyze the comedy, because that's what I do. I mean, I laugh a lot. I laughed a lot, but then I also look at how you structure your gags. And a lot of times you'll do the opposite of what that's what makes it funny. It's the opposite. Like, you had a space creature who had breasts where a person's eyes would be, and they're pointing to where their breasts would be, and they're saying, "Hey, buddy, my eyes are down here."
Right. Yeah, that is something that I find that I do a lot. I speak about creativity pretty often, and that is one of the sort of tricks that I know that I use. And first, it was subconscious, you know. Or I was just, I don't know, but subconscious, but I was not aware that I was doing it. But I found, you know, as I analyzed my process, that is something I do. I'll take something and think of its opposite, or I'll take something and if not its opposite, I'll just flip something in it. You know, like there's a pirate in the book, there's a cartoon with a pirate. Instead of the classic pirate has a hook for a hand, you know, Dr. Hook, I guess.
Right.
So I remember the idea for that was like, okay, what else could it be if I switched it from a hook to something else? And then in a way I was thinking, like, what's the opposite of like a scary hook? So I gave him a spatula for his hand, and then that led to him saying to his fellow pirate, you know, they're both kind of looking at it, he's saying, "I was in a different place then." It becomes like just a mild cartoon, but that's the beginning step of coming up with a creative thing. Often for me is flipping something or switching something.
I, in the back of New Yorker, for those of us who are smart and attractive, we read New Yorker every week. In the back of New Yorker, they have a little card contest where you can see a cartoon that has no caption, and your job, the reader, is to come up with some captions. And I look at those, and I can never in a million years think of a caption, and yet people come up with pretty funny ones.
Oh, yeah, people are great. I mean, the beauty of, like, group genius, I guess. It's tricky. That's a different task even than cartooning, because, you know, cartooning, I come up with it all together. So sometimes it's tough for me if I see somebody else's drawing to
think
come
of the
up
gag.
With the right line.
Yeah.
But that's an immensely popular feature. A lot of people.
Do you look at it and think of, you know, do you try to think of a gag every time?
I try not to, just because I would hate to come up with something great and then be like, well, why did I just spend time doing that? Because for one thing, I can't win the contest.
That's right, you're an employee.
You know, not allowed. And then plus, you know, I need to spend all my creative time coming up with my own cartoons that I can actually pitch.
When you say that, I mean, so, and you were just saying how you work at home, Matt Diffie. So do you get up in the morning and you sit down and you go, okay, time to write cartoons?
Yeah. I actually do. It shocks people. I think people think that we walk around and just life gives it to us. And you know, that happens very rarely for me, and maybe more often for some others. But it really, you know, it comes down to just being a job. One of my speeches about creativity is how to be an idea factory. And it's about as exciting as working at a factory. Mm-hmm. I get up. I can't say I get up in the morning. Often in the morning. But I get up when I get up, which is another beauty of this job.
Yeah.
I can stay up late and then get up late whenever I need to.
Do you put a tie on before you put a coat and tie?
Yes, I put on a coat and tie. No, I rarely put on pants.
but a coat and tie, always.
Tie, I make a pot of coffee and I, you know, basically I take an empty sheet of paper and a full pot of coffee, and I empty the pot of coffee and I fill the piece of paper. And, you know, it takes 2 or 3 hours in the morning. Uh-huh. And at the end of that, I've got a sheet full of little notes and little jots and, you know, little half ideas and a bunch of really bad ideas. I just write them all down because, you know, sometimes a bad idea will turn into a good idea or combined with another bad idea. And then there's always a couple that are pretty decent. And then I put that sheet away. That was Monday. And then Tuesday, I do the same thing. And then at the end of the week, I take these sheets back out because a little distance is always good for your ideas. you think everything's great when you just came up with it, but I think part of that is just the relief
of coming up with
of having come up with anything. And then at the end of the week, you know, you can look at it with, you know, a little bit of distance, and I go through and I circle it, that's still pretty good, and that's decent. And sometimes, you know, I'll even, oh, that's decent, but I forgot this, I can take this little, and this makes it better. And so then at the end of the week, you know, if I've done that work all along, I'll easily come up with 10 that I, you know, feel good enough about to sketch at least.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and then I sketch those up and send them in. And a couple of days later, we'll know whether we sold one or not.
Yeah, they're pretty quick about their coming back.
Yeah, we turn them in on Tuesday, and then I think we usually find out Thursday or Friday morning at the latest.
Do you confer with other New Yorker cartoonists ever?
Yeah, I used to do it more when I lived in New York, because part of the fun of it was we would come in on Tuesdays if you lived in town and actually deliver your work in person.
Mm.
I email it now. But that was fun, because then right after we did that, we'd all wander off to lunch together and talk shop and complain. And yeah, and occasionally, you know, you'd bring something up and you'd show it to your friends and say, here was one I had last week that you didn't take. And people are like, oh, that's good. Or they'll be like, oh, maybe if you change this, or maybe you did that. You know, it's a little sensitive, because you don't want to, you have to know that I am fortunate enough to have some really, really some of my best friends in the world are my fellow cartoonists, so.
You don't think they'll steal your ideas and use them?
No. Not on purpose. That is something that is a danger. You know, you'll see somebody's cartoon idea, and then 5 years later, you don't really remember that cartoon, but you're sitting there trying to think of a cartoon about a zebra. And he showed you a cartoon about a zebra 5 years ago, and you sometimes remembering his idea feels like coming up with it yourself.
Yeah.
So that can happen. And, you know, it's a shame. But I think, you know, at that point, you know, we're dealing with so many different ideas that nobody really holds too much ownership over one idea.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a sign of amateurism if you're really worried about your idea. You know, we're dealing with so many hundreds and hundreds a week.
I think most of the smart, attractive people who read New Yorker read the cartoons. Not only do they read them first, but then that's it. That's all they read.
Yeah, they're smart, attractive, but extremely busy readers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that's... I shouldn't say it, but I guess that's often what I do too. I used to, when I lived in New York, it was nice because, you know, you had the subway train ride, you know, which is often half an hour, 30 minutes,
right.
You know,
45 right.
minutes or whatever, and I could get through a lot of the New Yorker that way, just because you had it, and you had it in your bag, and you read it, but not so much anymore. I wonder how many people actually don't read a single article all year long in their subscription of the New Yorker. I bet you it's 20%.
20% that read the articles. And
yeah.
80% read the cartoons. But the cartoons,
yeah.
You know, I mean, that's actually must be a great feeling, Matt Diffie, to know that you're part of this legacy of this magazine that's
yeah.
been around since the 20s and all these great cartoonists and humorists that have contributed to it.
That is. It's a huge honor. And I, you know, I came to it fairly late, you know, sold my first cartoon at 29. And at that point, for my own quest, I was trying to, you know, find a place to be. It was just so gratifying to land here, of all places, at sort of the pinnacle of gag cartooning. And to me, you know, it's just so wonderful to, and in many cases, actually have lunch with these guys. You know, George Booth is one of my heroes,
yeah.
And Kay and Wilson, and, you know, these guys who really built this platform that the rest of us young fellas, and I don't know if I can count myself young anymore, but I certainly have benefited and hopefully added a brick or two of my own. And that's why those cartoons, like the Desert Island things and the Grim Reaper things,
uh-huh.
are so fun to do, because you feel like you're adding to the
legacy, to the
you're carrying
the tradition.
It on and giving it one more tweak, you know, one more twist.
I mean, how many Desert Island ones with the guy crawling through?
I have no idea. I bet you there's thousands.
Yeah.
It would not surprise me. And you know, but and still people are coming up with new ones. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
For one thing, there's new stuff. Like there's new, like you could do a somebody taking a selfie on a desert island. They couldn't have thought of that 20
That's
years
right.
ago. So
That's right.
as long as there's new stuff, we can keep putting new
twist.
Twists on it. Yeah.
When Gay and Wilson walks into the room, is he like all blobby and he's just there?
Melted looking? Yeah. No, he is a very suave, attractive fellow.
Oh, he can reach
very, speaks very, I don't know, a little flowery. He's a great guy. Good laugher, good listener, good storyteller.
Are there? I know there's a lot of comic book conventions. Do they have comics strip?
Oh, you don't really. It's funny how segregated cartoonists are, as mm-hmm. far as like the comics people, and then the newspaper strip people, and the editorial people, and then the New Yorker people.
Yeah.
And I guess the Mad Magazine people, and then the, I don't know, animation people. It's funny how little crossover there is. I wish there was some sort of a. I mean, I guess it would have to be. I guess the distinction of what I do. Well, I don't know. I was gonna say, like, to me, maybe it's just because I come from a stand-up background. To me, it's comedy. What I'm doing is comedy,
mm-hmm.
More than it is art. Even I guess maybe I take the art part for granted because I was always, you know, the kid who drew well. But I think most people think of cartooning as the drawing part, and to me, it's always more about the comedy part. That's where 90% of my work goes, and that's what I'm most proud of, I guess. And I like to think that that's what me and my cronies at the New Yorker are after, despite what you might have heard.
I thought you guys were out trying to get laid.
Yeah, well, no, that we would have done many other things than cartooning, I assure you. I think we're trying to be funny.
Well,
that'll be the title of my autobiography. I'm trying to be funny.
Well, you've succeeded because I was reading this wonderful book, which I think all of my listeners should pick up right away. It's called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People. And it's a collection of fabulous New Yorker cartoons and other cartoons from Matthew Diffie. And I want to thank you for spending some time talking about it on From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, thank you. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Matthew Diffie. His book is called Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People, a compilation of his hilarious New Yorker cartoons and others. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.